We'll listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies.
I'm Ronnie Allen, and it is my pleasure to introduce a gentleman who is a singer, a musician, a composer, a general Renaissance man, and also, not the least important, a horror movie lover. And he is best known for his 1978 million-selling single record, which is called Magnet and Steel. Ladies and gentlemen, an El Cheapo drum roll. I can't even afford the drum. I have on the phone with me Mr. Walter Egan. Walter, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ronnie. I always love to talk about myself.
Well, you have plenty of opportunity today. Speaking of Magnet and Steel, which we're going to discuss at length in a few moments, but we're going to kind of do it chronologically as far as your hit records are concerned.
Sure.
I read something. Now, this is truly, it sounds like it's life imitating art. You have a record called Magnet and Steel, and you're singing, You Are the Magnet, and there is a lady that I read. Now, of course, this report was in The Sun. At any rate, for what it's worth, this British woman reportedly can hold coins, safety pins, and magnets to her head and chest for nearly 45 minutes. And not only that, her presence can blow light bulbs and set off car alarms. Did you hear about her?
I did. I noticed that story the other day, and I was blown away by it. I've heard of a magnetic personality, but I think that's carrying it to the extreme.
Far beyond what you were singing about in Magnet and Steel, I take it.
Yes, we were speaking metaphorically.
You were not really singing about a woman who could do that.
No, but it's nice to know that there's one out there, at least.
Reportedly. Walter, at some point during the interview, in fact, toward the end of the interview, I'm going to ask you about your top 10 horror films. We can't do Siskel and Ebert, but we could do Allen and Egan.
Sounds great.
You were born in Jamaica, New York, I believe.
That is correct.
What were your early influences in music? Was it rock and roll?
Well, of course, when you're very young, you're exposed to your parents' tastes in music, and my parents were of the generation that Frank Sinatra was the king, and the Dixieland jazz was a big favorite of my stepfather's. My mother loved the Broadway show tunes and that type of stuff, so I heard that around the house. But the epiphany moment, of course, was Elvis and his appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. So it's sad to say, but I'm old enough to remember that and remember the thrill that it gave me when I saw him the first time up there.
Did you like rockabilly?
I did. I mean, well, when rock and roll started, and there were really two ways to go, it seemed to me. There was the doo-wop sound, the sound of the city, the a cappella vocal groups that sang in harmony, which I loved. Many of them were very much one-hit wonders, I guess, when you look back at it. But, yeah, and the rockabilly, that was really what started rock and roll. I think Elvis was combining the country sound with kind of a blues thing, and that's what rockabilly was. So, yeah, I loved rockabilly. The whole Sun Records thing with Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and even Johnny Cash to some degree.
When you started out, were you a singer or an instrumentalist?
If you're going way back to the way back time, I mean, we all wanted to be Elvis. I had a plastic Mickey Mouse guitar that I used to imitate Elvis with. But when it came time to get an instrument, let me give you a little bit of the background. I am an only child, but I have a second cousin who is like a brother to me. We were born 15 minutes apart in the same hospital, same doctor, and I'm 15 minutes older than he is. And so we grew up together as brothers, and his name is Jim Honeycutt. And if Jim did something, I had to, of course, keep pace with him. And around this time, around 59, 60, 61, the folk music boom happened, and mostly from Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary and that type of more popish folk. There was a TV show called Hootenanny, and this was, for those of us who started with Elvis and that crazy kind of music in the mid-50s. By the time 1960 came along, that music had been watered down a little bit, and it was Fabian instead of Elvis, and it wasn't quite the same. So folk music came along, and it seemed like it was speaking to us, whether we were just being manipulated by the media or not, I don't know, but we loved it. So Jim got a long-neck five-string banjo, and for me to keep pace with him, I had to get a guitar. So it was the summer of my 15th birthday. I was on vacation with my parents in Nantucket, as a matter of fact. We had a cabin, and there was a piano in the cabin. And I would sit there because I, as much as, you know, we all love our parents, but at this point I was kind of, I'd rather be somewhere else than hanging out with my parents. And so they'd be out walking around Nantucket, and I'd stay in the cabin, and I would just sit there and pick out tunes on the piano. I had no schooling on the piano. Nobody in my family was really musical, except, of course, my cousin had this banjo thing going on. But I shocked my mother. My mother came in, and I was like, you're picking out melodies. You're a genius, you know. It's like, well, no, we're going to get you a piano. We're going to get you piano lessons. And I go, no, I don't want the piano, and I don't want piano lessons, but I do want a guitar, and I don't want guitar lessons. I just want to teach myself to play. So they acceded to my wishes there, and my birthday was coming up shortly thereafter in the middle of July. So they took me, but of course, as I started thinking logically about it, I thought, well, maybe I should get a four-string guitar because I only have four fingers to use. And so I really was a complete novice in every way.
Were there four-string guitars? I thought guitars had six-string.
Yeah, actually there were. And speaking of the Kingston Trio were a big influence at this particular moment in our lives. Nick Reynolds, who was the short guy in the Kingston Trio, played a tenor guitar, which was a four-string. So I was thinking that's the way to go. I went to a music store. It was called Scribner's in Manhattan, New York. I grew up in Queens, New York. And I was convinced that I could handle the six-string guitar. So I got what was called a Goya F11 guitar. And the big selling point was that it could use either nylon or steel strings. And I got a Kingston Trio songbook that had the pictures of the chords. I spent the whole summer, every day, every night, I would sit there with my Kingston Trio songbook because I knew how the songs went, and I would teach myself how to make the chords and suffer through what happens to young guitarists when they try to start playing and get calluses and your fingers hurt. And soon my cousin Jim and I were jamming on a Kingston Trio song. This was just before going into sophomore year of high school. I was also, as you mentioned, a Renaissance man, so I was actually playing basketball in eighth grade, and I had attracted the attention of the coach of the basketball team of a high school called Loyola in Manhattan. I was able to get a scholarship to Loyola, so I wound up going to Manhattan and went to high school on the subway every day. And at Loyola, I met this guy named John Zambetti. He had taken lessons already, and he had a band. At that time, the band was called the Moondogs, and he said if I got an electric guitar, I could join the band. So I convinced my parents that it would be in all of our best interest if I could get an electric guitar and make some big money playing the electric guitar.
Absolutely.
And so I got myself a Fender Stratocaster, brand new one, and eventually learned how to play electric from John Zambetti, who had changed the name of the band at this point to the Malibu's, the M-A-L-I-B-O-O-Z, Booze. If you spell it the real way with an S on it, people would think it said Malibus. We did mostly instrumental stuff. We did like Ventures, and there were a number of one-hit wonders that had instrumental hits around that time. We started playing at school functions and school dances and stuff. So I came in the back door as a musician. I had really no music theory going for me. I just continued to pick it up as I'd watch people play and learned how to play rhythm guitar. I was actually the rhythm guitar player in that band.
Were you totally self-taught?
No, I never took any lessons. John was taking some lessons at the time. When he would learn something, he would pass it along to me in one form or another, and I'd go home and practice it. Within that first year of having a guitar, I started writing songs. I was inspired to write my first song by a song called Leader of the Pack by the Shangri-Las. Mm-hmm. And actually, at the rock convention, it was funny because Mary Weiss, who was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las, was there. And I went up to her and I said, oh, it's so great to meet you. I was inspired to start writing songs by your song, Leader of the Pack. And she was, like, mortified. She said, couldn't you have picked a better song? That song is terrible. I said, but that's the whole point, you know. That's what made me feel I could write.
It was a number one song, actually.
Well, yeah, it was a great song and in its own genre, but, you know, for me, what it was is that, well, this is such a silly song, I could write this.
Did you start to do some vocalizing with your band?
Well, now that came about a year later. We were playing at kind of a school dance party, and this guy came up and requested Louie Louie, which is a notorious song, and he, you know, with a wink, he said, "Oh yeah, and do the good lyrics," you know.
Yeah.
And even though we were an instrumental band, we did bring a microphone along with us to make announcements with, but we had no mic stand. So, you know, I guess I was the bravest of the bunch, and I said, yeah, sure, I can sing that. So we found a plastic palm plant that was about, you know, 5 feet tall, and we stuck the microphone in the plastic palm plant as a mic stand, and I sang Louie Louie through a Fender Princeton amp, which was our PA at the time. And this guy was down on the floor. He was sitting on the floor with his ear next to the speaker.
Yeah.
And he was, like, digging it. He was like, oh, yeah. And, then, and I was just, all I was doing was mumbling through the lyrics. I knew the chorus, of course. So I learned very early on that attitude and approach had as much to do with success in music as really knowing the words and being able to sing it. It was quite interesting how it all evolved. By that time, we had started writing some songs, and John and I were in a friendly competition of songwriting at that point. He had written a song with a friend of ours named Chris Murray called Going to Malibu, which was going to be the theme song for the Malibus. And I wrote a song called That's a Lie, which I think was suggested by one of the lines in a Beatles song at that time. So we went into this radio station called WRVR. There was one microphone in the middle of the room, and we set up around it, and we sang into it, and it was all recorded mono and one mic, and it was quite an experience. You know, we loved it. We brought it to parties. We had acetates made, and we would bring them in there, and hey, you know, this is it. Of course, when you start playing in a band, you realize that there's a few different levels that it's operating on. You
sure.
You know, the personal satisfaction of being able to play a song and the fun of that, but you know, all of a sudden these girls are paying attention to you that necessarily wouldn't be paying attention to you because you're standing up there with a guitar. So it dawned on me that this could be a good thing to do. I never took it seriously. I loved doing it, and I loved getting it together with the guys and playing. It was an epiphany, again, that I couldn't deny, but I never took it seriously. I went to Georgetown University. Everybody in the band except the bass player went to Georgetown. So we went en masse from Loyola to Georgetown and continued playing. Picked up a bass player at Georgetown and kept playing, but mostly covers. You know, at this point we were doing the Beatles and the whole Stones, English Invasion. We did a few Beach Boys songs, even though we weren't quite singing up to their standard yet. All throughout college, we kept playing and met a woman named Annie McClune, who became the lead singer of the band. John became enamored with becoming a doctor, so he went off on his own, and I became the lead guitar player. And by this time, we had quite a nice repertoire of originals that we could start playing. So we started doing that about halfway through college, and then as it got to graduation, our band was doing pretty well. So by the time I graduated, all of a sudden it dawned on me that I could actually do this for a living. And
wow,
then so it wasn't really until I graduated from college that I thought, well, let's give this a shot. I had written a number of songs by this time. There was a woman, an old black woman, who did a record in D.C. just around the time that I graduated. Her name was Esther Mae Scott, or Mama Scott, and I think you can still find her record out there somewhere. She cut one of my tunes, a song of mine called Come to Me. That quickly gave way to one of the amazing thrills of my life. Through high school and college, I became a Byrds fan, you know, from Mr. Tambourine Man all the way on from there. In 1968, they came out with a record called Sweetheart of the Rodeo, which was totally out of left field at that time.
Right.
It was a real country record, country and western, as they called it back then.
In South Carolina, there are many tall pines.
It is the Byrds.
That's not the Byrds.
Okay, listen to this one.
I don't care how many letters they send. Morning came, morning went. Pack up your money, pick up your tent. You ain't going nowhere.
See, it is the Byrds. They're doing Dylan.
It can't be the Byrds. Play another tune.
There can't be any children. A story I will tell. Laughter above for the outlaw.
It's the Byrds, all right.
Nah, that ain't the Byrds.
For their latest Columbia album, Sweetheart of the Rodeo, the Byrds take 11 trips to the country. Why not fly with them?
Ronnie, that is so cool, man. Where'd you get that?
I can't tell you. It's a military secret. But I can tell you that it's exactly the way you felt about what you thought the Byrds would do or would not do. So,
exactly. It was a shock to the system. You have to look back at the times. And in that time, like 68, the country was as polarized as it had been in my lifetime, and certainly not as polarized until recent years when polarization seemed to be the more. And actually, even today, I guess it's still that way. You were either with us or against us. It was the whole Vietnam War time, and it was the whole period of the counterculture and the hippie movement, if you want to call it that. You know, it was the baby boomers coming of age and realizing they really didn't have to stick with the way their parents did it. So all of a sudden there was this record by my favorite group, and it was country music, and I was going, this is crazy, I can't listen to this. And I started listening to it, and by the time I had listened to it two or three times, I was like, wow, this is really good. And I looked at the credits, and there was a guy on the label whose name was Graham Parsons, and this was just a name to me at that point. But from then on, I pursued finding out about him. I should also say that while I was at Georgetown, I had a radio show on the campus station, WGTB-FM, the voice of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
That was your DJ voice?
Yes, that was my DJ voice, thank you. So I was, you know, very much into obscure music anyway. The whole San Francisco sound loomed large in my legend, as they said. I loved the Airplane and Grateful Dead. By this time, the Malibus had transferred into a band called Sageworth. Surf music being not part of the current, you know, surf music was good in the early 60s and mid-60s, and then all of a sudden it became, you know, something you didn't necessarily want to be. So we were doing Sageworth, which was sort of a combination of Buffalo Springfield and Byrds and San Francisco music and some English stuff, but with Annie McClune singing lead for the most part. I was still writing, and we would work in about half original material, but mostly we were still doing covers. And when this country music thing started, it was like, well, let's take a look at this, because nothing could be more radical than this right-wing redneck music being done by a hippie band. You know, it's hard to imagine that at this point, but that's really what it was. So I was very taken by Graham Parsons, and I followed him up. And soon the Flying Burrito Brothers came along, and Graham, of course, being the leader of that with Chris Hillman. And so I, you know, got into more country sounds. I got a lap steel and tried to start playing that, and we were doing country-flavored stuff, and, you know, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but not totally. There was some legitimate sincerity to it that we were trying to, at least as far back as the rock bands that we were emulating, to be doing it. So flash forward a couple of years to after graduation, Sageworth was playing the circuit in the Georgetown, Washington, D.C. area, and there were actually a lot of talented people playing that time at that point. Roy Buchanan was in that circuit. Roberta Flack was in that circuit. A guy named Bill Danoff had a band called Fat City.
Oh, yeah.
And at that point, he had written a song that John Denver picked up on called Take Me Home, Country Roads. These people were all playing, and these were all our peers. We were playing the same clubs. And also in that mix was a woman named Emmylou Harris. We all kind of fell in love with Emmylou. She was doing kind of folky pop stuff at that point.
She became a huge country artist.
She did, but at that point, she really wasn't into country. She wasn't playing country music at all.
Tremendous talent.
Oh, yeah. She's great. So we were down there watching her play one night at a club called Clyde's when Chris Hillman walked in, and I recognized him, of course, being the Byrds fan that I am. Said, oh my God, it's Chris Hillman. The Flying Burrito Brothers were playing at a club called the Cellar Door down the block. That was, of course, the spark that led to Graham and Emmy singing together. When he approached Emmy, Emmy had no idea who Graham Parsons was, and so I had to take her home and play Sweetheart of the Rodeo and Flying Burrito Brothers for her and say, hey, yeah, you gotta look into this. This guy has got something. So in the following days, or I think it might have been even a week later, that Graham came down. I think he was in Baltimore at the time. So I met him. He came by while Emmy was singing, and I was introduced to him, and he and Emmy needed a place to get together the next day to sing, and I offered the kitchen in what was called the Sageworth House. We, of course, in those days all lived together as a band, and we did everything together. So the next day, Graham and Emmy sang together for the first time in my kitchen, and I was sitting there watching them. It was a wonderful thrill for me. Yeah, and so I said, Graham, I want to get into country music. Who should I listen to? What should I do? He was wearing his Flying Burrito Brothers nudie jacket, and just oozing charisma, and I was like, well, you know, Merle Haggard and George Jones and Harlan Howard and Charlie Pride. So I took that as my homework, and I started listening to that stuff. And then by the time Emmy was going out there to record the GP album with him, I had written this song called Hearts on Fire. It was still a bit tongue-in-cheek when I wrote it, and the bass player for Sageworth was a guy named Tom Geiderer, and Tom recognized that this could be actually a good song, and so he said, oh, well, we'll just change a couple of those tongue-in-cheek lyrics and try to make it more serious. So that, sure enough, we made a little tape of it and gave it to Emmy to bring out to Graham, and they wound up recorded it on the last album he did before he died. It was called Grievous Angel.
Writers and she would, you know, give them a showcase. Her band at that time,
included Glenn Frey and Don Henley. So all those guys came over to that same Sageworth house where Graham and Emmy had sung. And we sat around playing old Everly Brothers songs and playing old Merle Haggard songs and just kind of getting to know one another. It was a wonderful thing for me because this whole L.A. country rock scene was very big in my mind at that point. And that's really what lured me out there. So by the time we broke up after moving to Boston and that whole thing I just described, I went out and stayed with that guy, Chris Darrow. And Chris had been in the Kaleidoscope, and he was also in Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and he was doing some solo records at that time. He's a really talented guy and a very important person in the whole music scene. Well, I had been staying at his house for maybe a week, and the tour he was about to do of the United Kingdom was hampered by the fact that United Artists Records, which was his label, had withdrawn their tour support for him. So he asked me if I wanted to be his band. So I said, yeah, sure. I came to California, but what the heck? Let's go to England. So I spent the next month, basically, with him touring with a band called the Man Band, M-A-N, the Man Band. We're kind of the San Francisco band from Wales. They love that kind of music, and I got to know those people. But most importantly, I met this guy named Andrew Lauder, and Andrew Lauder was Chris's A&R man at that label. So flash forward to me being in L.A. for maybe a year or so, and we did a hoot night, as they called them, at the Troubadour, where we played six or seven songs. I sang one of the songs, although I wrote six out of the seven of the songs. And Andrew Lauder happened to be in the audience with a guy named Greg Lewick, who was kind of the A&R guy for Chris at United Artists in America. So afterwards, I found out that Andrew wanted to offer me a six-side deal with United Artists UK, which meant I could do three singles. So when we had that deal in place, we looked for producers. This band at that point was a band called Wheels. That was the name of the band that I had assembled out in Claremont, California, which is really where I was living, not quite in L.A. And we had worked at a studio called Sound City. And Sound City happened to be the same studio where Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks had done the Buckingham Nicks album, and also was the same studio where Fleetwood Mac did what has become to be known as their White album, which is the first album that Stevie and Lindsey worked on. So when we're looking for producers, the engineer who I had worked with, Dwayne Scott, said, well, how about Buckingham Nicks? And I'm going, who the heck is Buckingham Nicks? I had no idea who they were. And he said, well, they're from Fleetwood Mac. And to me, Fleetwood Mac at that point was Bob Welch and the Bermuda Triangle and, you know, jam blues, which wasn't really what I was trying to do. Right. He said, no, just listen to the record, you'll see. This was in 76. Bob Welch had left, actually, the middle of 74, but I wasn't necessarily keeping up with them at that point. I had just seen some performance called Bermuda Triangle. They had a song called Bermuda Triangle, which was this long, long jam, which was okay, but, you know, it wasn't really what I was trying to do at that point. Yeah. To me, that's who Fleetwood Mac was. That and Black Magic Woman, which I had gotten a single of when I was back on the radio at Georgetown, the original version of that song. Peter Green and the whole original Fleetwood Mac. Now we're like in 76. February of 76 is when we did the Hoot Night at the Troubadour. So we approached Buckingham Nicks, and I got together with Lindsey. I met them at a concert in Santa Barbara. And, of course, loved the band when I saw them play, and loved Stevie. Stevie, it turned out, was born a week after Annie McClune. So it turned out that Lindsey and I had been living parallel lives on separate coasts.
Wow.
His band, Fritz.
Without knowing it.
Yeah, well, basically it was, because he was influenced by Beach Boys and Kingston Trio, and so was I. And he had this band where he had the female singer, and he was... It was very similar. And my middle name is Lindsey, and so there were a lot of things that led me to believe this was going to be a good thing. So they agreed to be the producer as a team for my first album.
Was this going to be on United Artists?
Okay, well, once we had Buckingham Nicks as producers, then Greg Lewick, who by this time had become my manager, went to Columbia Records, and Fleetwood Mac was getting very hot at that point. So they offered me a six-album deal instead of a six-song deal.
Oh.
So things were starting to accelerate for me in my young career at this point. So we worked around the rumor schedule and Fleetwood Mac touring schedule and recorded Fundamental Role starting in 76. It was released early in 77.
And the first single from that happened to be called, let me get it right, Only the Lucky. I got it right.
Yeah,
and,
all right.
And since I just mentioned that, let's play it right now. This is from the album, Fundamental Role, Only the Lucky. This is Walter Egan.
I dreamed that you would never believe in me. I still recall what you had to say. You said that you would always believe in me. Then I woke and I always do. My dream was gone like darkness from the sky. But the pain and it's all the truth. Only the lucky loves to die.
Well documented their whole breakup while they were still touring and recording. And so Lindsay and I and an engineer named Richard Dashett were the producers of the second album. And the Ooze in the background are Lindsay, Stevie, and Annie McClune. Stevie came in and sang on, you know, probably not as many songs as she did on Fundamental Role. And she was on Magnet and Steel, and of course she knew that it was about her.
Remember our song, and they stick a cassette in the car
cassette player, and there I am singing Magnet and Steel. And they kiss, and she also has a necklace, and they're both magnetic, and they click together. It's quite a touching little scene. Not quite as touching as the Magnetic Woman in England, but still. You mentioned how long it took Magnet and Steel to be on the charts. It was released in March, and so the stations that had gone on it early, by the time summer came along, were going to what they saw as the next single, because, of course, this was all singles-oriented
right.
time.
Which was?
And the song Hot Summer Nights became like this
yeah.
deep track of that summer. And I thought that Columbia was going to release it by the end of the summer, at least by the middle of the summer. But they didn't release it until almost November of that year.
But that's because Magnet and Steel was still hanging around.
Exactly. They kept plugging that, which, you know, of course is great. It really peaked in September of that year. It took, you know, a good 6 months to get to its highest point.
Hot Summer Night is the next one, and this is a song with a tremendously interesting history. First of all, it's very different from Magnet and Steel. This one is closer to rockabilly. It's much more up-tempo.
Well, that's the weird thing about Magnet and Steel in the beginning anyway. I mean, I was really a rocker. I was making what I thought was a rock album. Rock was what I wanted to do, and the kind of M.O.R. ballad thing, there was going to be one song on the record, basically, or maybe two, that were was going to be that part of me, but 90% of that record is me rocking out. So, of course, it was funny that, all of a sudden there I was, you know, being promoted as the kind of teenage balladeer, heartthrob guy, and, you know, which was, you know, any promotion at that point was fine, but it was not showing what I did. In my live show, I had been performing a song that was written by Stevie called Sisters of the Moon. And I loved the song, and I wanted to do it, and I wanted to record it, and yet when it came to record it, Lindsay was like, I don't think so. I don't think you should do that song. I didn't want you to do some other song. And this was going to be like the closing song on my album. It was going to be like the big climax. So I was like, what? This is my record. Come on, man. She said, no, really, don't do it. Go home and write something new. So I went home. It was the middle of the summer. I started thinking about the Malibus. I started thinking about Sageworth. I started thinking about all the bands I'd been in. And I wrote a song that was not a love song, except in the sense that I loved having been in these bands and played with these people. But it never mentions the word love or anything like that. It was a song about being in a band. It just sort of came out, and I recorded it the next day. I did, within 24 hours of writing that song, I recorded it. Hot Summer Nights.
Yes.
And so, in a sense, it was Lindsay's adamant that I didn't do Stevie's song.
Oh, wow. So there might not have even been a Hot Summer Nights if it wasn't for that.
Exactly. So it's a funny thing how things happen, isn't it?
Normally what I would do at this point would be to play your recording, but instead of doing that, I want to fast forward. You actually released the single, and it got to number 55 on the chart, which was not bad, but then another group remade the song a few months later, and the group was called Night.
Yes, it was the first release on Richard Perry's label, Planet Records.
The
lead singer was actually also
girl.
Named Stevie Lang. Yeah. Well, I think it was quite obvious they were trying to cash in on the Fleetwood Mac success of that time, and, you know, Stevie and Lindsay and that whole thing.
That group called Night recorded the song, and they took it up to number 18 on the chart. So that was your song, making it with your version, with their version.
Actually, to fill you in, there were actually a few other versions.
Oh,
oddly enough, for a song that was written to be such a personal song about, you know, sending up all my friends, it became the most covered song I ever wrote.
Yes.
There soon was a Japanese version. There was a French version called Vin de l'Evla, which is kind of translated as 22 Skidoo. There was a Swedish version called Flat Summer Dag. There was a German version, a Japanese version. I even covered it with the Malibus. I rewrote the lyrics for it to talk mostly about the Malibus. It's an amazing thing for three chords in a song that's
amazing.
Got such mileage.
It's like your Stardust, your Yesterday. This is your song that got recorded by so many different people.
Exactly. And then, you know, like those locusts that go to sleep for 20 years, all of a sudden it came back last year as the inspiration for Eminem's comeback single, We Made You. And they had to play that song for me on the telephone because they were afraid of sending me an MP3 that I would leak it because it was such a big deal that he is coming back after 5 years, blah, blah, blah. But if you listen to his version, which isn't really a version of my song, obviously.
What Eminem did was not really a sample, right?
It wasn't a sample. It wasn't a needle drop. It wasn't the hook. It wasn't the guitar riff. It was kind of the melody, kind of the feel. But if you listen to the Night version and then listen to We Made You, you can see the connection much stronger than you could if you just listen to my version.
We're going to put the three of them together, and you'll be able to see the connection. But you're listed as a co-writer of the Eminem record. Is that correct?
I am. I'm one of five writers of that song. So you can figure my percentage that way.
I believe it was a top 10 record.
Yeah, I think I got to number 9. I still haven't met him. I still have no idea how that came about, whether he was like a young rocker that heard Night's version or just happened to be something that somebody pulled out of the air and said, hey, how about this?
So this is a kind of a medley. This is Walter Egan with his version of Hot Summer Nights, which he wrote. And then we'll hear a little bit of the Night version of Hot Summer Nights. And then we'll hear a little bit of that Eminem song, which kind of borrows pretty heavily from Hot Summer Nights, We Made You. Name of the film, and you could tell me maybe a sentence or two about it. Walter Egan, number 10, is The Dead Zone.
Yeah, The Dead Zone. It had a young Christopher Walken in it, and I'm not sure if that was Stephen King or not. It certainly felt like it.
Eerie movie, right? Kind of deceptively eerie, as you said.
It was. And I think Martin Sheen actually played a candidate for president in that.
Number 9, ladies and gentlemen, is the only one that I have personally seen of the 10, and it's The Exorcist.
Well, The Exorcist, what can you say about The Exorcist? It's a wonderful film, a sweet, innocent little film. For me, of course, it's great because I went to Georgetown University, which is where it takes place, and they do film in location there. And in fact, you'll know that the truth of the matter is the stairs that they throw them down, down the stairs out of the window of the house. Well, the house is a whole like 100 feet away from the stairs. In reality, there is no house next to the stairs.
Oh, okay. Little secret there.
Number
8 is Red Planet Mars.
Ah, well, Red Planet Mars is certainly a classic from the 50s. I think Leslie Nielsen, the guy who went on to do the police and the airport movies, he was an actor in that movie. I was at Mick Fleetwood's for some party one night, and the movie came on TV. And talk about surrealistic moments. I was watching a movie with Tony Curtis. I was sitting in this room watching with Tony Curtis, and he was, like, talking about Leslie Nielsen, and I'm going, look, there's an X on the back of the guy's neck. It means he's, you know, it's a great movie. If you get a chance to
see it. Number 7 is a movie that has been on some lists. It's been called the worst movie of all time, but it has also developed one of the biggest cult followings of all time, and I think it's far from the worst from what I've heard. It's called Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Oh, you've got to love Ed Wood and his oeuvre, as they say. His work stands alone with Glenn and Glenda and Plan 9 from Outer Space, and then I can't remember the other one, right?
It was actually kind of a satire thing. Well, it was zany. It was a zany movie, really.
It was zany, but the guy just had this style in it. And, of course, it was fed by the fact that he had no money to make these movies, so it was all the mother of invention kind of approach to making special effects. It's a great movie. You've got to see that. If you haven't seen it, I'm sure you can forget it.
Number 6 is a movie, your comment here was those zombies are relentless, and the movie is called The Night of the Living Dead.
Well, they just keep coming, you know, and you would think that they're moving so slow you could get out of the way, but of course that put the Pittsburgh movie business on the map that was made in Pittsburgh.
Now, we've got a 1956 classic, which comes in as your number 5 movie, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Terror, as you call it.
It is. It's a wonderful kind of mind bleep when you watch, all of a sudden these people you think you know are actually turning into these aliens. And of course, in the latter years, I've read, treatments about it where it says it's about communism and it's about, people sort of turning into communists as opposed to turning into aliens. And this was during the Red Scare, as they call it.
Number 4 is The Horror of Dracula, Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
Well, usually I go for the original, I think we'll get to that in a minute. But The Horror of Dracula was kind of the last movie I saw in a theater that, as a very young person, I just got totally scared by. And I'm not even sure why at this point.
Yeah,
but
11 years old, according to this, and it said it scared the hell out of me.
It did. It was, and I saw it in Manhattan with my parents, and we went to see the fireworks after that. I think it was the 4th of July that I saw that, as a matter of fact. But, The Horror of Dracula, Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, they certainly established themselves as latter-day, kind of leaders in the horror film genre for me at that point.
Now, number 3 is interesting for a couple of reasons. A lot of people don't associate Michael Landon as a horror movie actor, but he was the star of this one, and it was also the inspiration for the record we're going to close the show with called Full Moon Fire, and the movie was called I Was a Teenage Werewolf.
Well, when I wrote Full Moon Fire, it's really about encountering the werewolf in all of our souls, it's that part of us that wants to go crazy and go out and howl at the moon, And so when we came time to, that was actually the first single from my last LP,
right,
which was done on Backstreet Records, which was, of course, Tom Petty's label. And I suggested, well, why don't we do, I was a teenage werewolf. I mean, Michael Landon's from Forest Hills, I was from Forest Hills. It's kind of the idea, and so we kind of went with that as the theme of the video. So
wow.
I feel like I owned it. But, of course, it's Full Moon Fire, F-O-O-L,
Moonfire. Yeah, I said it right, by the way. I did say it right. I said Full Moon Fire. And number 2, I guess, was the original Dracula movie, right? Dracula?
Oh, it was the Gothic, Bela Lugosi.
Yes.
Children of the Night, they make such sweet music.
Oh, that's the way you did that.
Yes, Dracula was a wonderful movie. Just so creepy and so gothic. And in latter days, there was a new version of it that they came out with. The original movie, but they put like a new soundtrack to it. Supposed to be scary, and it didn't make it for me. You got to go to the original.
And number one, and this is the number one on Walter Egan's Terror Bull, that's TerrorBlE, top 10 films of a scary nature. Number one, The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Indeed. And the costuming in that is just wonderful, isn't it? You can see the seams on the side of the guy. But when I saw it, Actually, I saw it with another movie called Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
That would be like number 11, right?
Yeah, I think it would be, because that was one I saw with my cousin, and we came back, and I was staying over at his house, and we couldn't sleep because we kept seeing monsters in the shadows in the room, and I just remember that being a very early scare to me. And, of course, one of my favorite artists, Dave Edmonds, came along with a song called The Creature from the Black Lagoon later on.
Walter, thank you so much for doing this show with me. I'm going to play that final record, which is Full Moon Fire. I wanted to make sure I got the title right. And it was actually, you made a video for this one, too, that came a little bit before Thriller. But some people think it might have inspired Michael Jackson's. I don't know.
I'm not saying that he stole it, but I'm just saying it sure looks a lot like it.
Okay.
And I just wanted to mention before we go that I'm still vitally doing music. I play as much as possible. I've got a band called the Walternative Band. I've done, five other records at least solo since my LP era.
Great.
And you can find me at walteregan.net or on iTunes or CD Baby. And, I'm out there, and the Malibus are still vital. We just put out a new CD called Queen's English, which is our surf band's take on the English sound of the mid-60s. We even have the Quarrymen on there with us, which was John Lennon's original band.
Yeah.
So, I'm still doing it. I love it, and I'm not going to stop until they lock me up.
And hopefully that's not going to happen for quite some time.
Right.
We close the show right now with Walter Egan song. Was this from an album?
It was. It's called Wild Exhibitions. It came out on Backstreet Records, and it's actually available now on Renaissance Records. It's on CD.
All right.
So it's out there. You can find it.
It's called Full Moon Fire.
Aroo!
I left in a joke with my
to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies.
Well, that's the show. Now a couple of bonus tracks. First off, we have Walter Egan and his group, the Malibus, doing Going to Malibu. Finally, we have a Thunderbird song. No, it's not about a black and white Thunderbird. It's a different color Thunderbird. This is Walter Egan doing The Blonde in the Blue T-Bird.